however long it takes to tell a story is however long it takes to tell a story. And I don't want to like ever pigeonhole ourselves into a different way of doing it. It's just however it evolves is how it evolves. And that's always like my ethos, is just let it breathe.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Danny McMahon, aka Dodford on YouTube. He's a filmmaker and documentarian known for his portraits of pop culture icons. We talk about filmmaking and art, storytelling and inspiration, simplicity and experimentation, identifying your talent, psychology, and more. Please enjoy.
You've been interested in film for a long time, since you were a kid. But I think to pick a particular genre or kind of sub-medium within film, there's always some reasoning behind that. Why did documentaries in particular stand out to you and resonate with you? What was it about the genre?
It started out as a logistical thing. Just as a creative, for so many years as a kid and teenager, when you have that urge, it's like an itch to be making something, but I didn't, you know, when you don't have the means to be actually to make something, it's torturous sometimes. And so when I knew that I wanted to start taking long form seriously on YouTube, it was a logistical thing. I was like, how can I use all this knowledge that I feel like I've built up and start telling stories without having to worry about the hassle of going to film and finding things out in the real world, you know, like documentaries from other people's stories, from existing sources of content that already were out there. It was like the perfect playground and my way to practice stitching stuff together with editing and creating something new from old things. And so, like, you know, things like Sidemen, things like my Nardwuar documentary, there were like early days of me working out like, okay, how far can I take this? This stuff's already out there. I'm not creating really anything new. I'm just putting it together and assembling it in a way that is new. And then after a while, like that's how it started. It was like, I've always had a crazy fascination with documentaries. It's something that in doing so, I've fallen in love with, because now, I've just grown a real fascination with people in general that I don't think I had before. And the links between us and the overlapping stories, because I there's a bit of a joke in my team called the Dodverse, where we find like all these, when we're doing the research, we find all these hidden links and overlapping paths of all these different subjects we cover, and how one person was really key to another person. That like only in building a library like this, I realized, wow, we're all so connected and everything overlaps. I fucking love that. You know, it's really, really cool. But really, yeah, it was just the beginning. It was like, how can I start telling stories without having to worry about making them, you know?
What are those common attributes you alluded to that you found in your subjects, either in hindsight or intentionally? What has kind of been the through line of the criteria or characteristics of those subjects?
I think, well, for one, they have to be someone that like truly inspires me just as an individual. Otherwise I'm going to just lose steam in it if I'm kind of uninspired by a person throughout. And so, yeah, that's criteria number one. We are going through the channel is very sort of 1990s nostalgia at the moment. So people who were in their peak then, in the 90s, kind of preying on that era, that's what I'm most interested in at the moment. We are going to start shifting decades eventually, and there'd be a nice timeline to the channel. But really, no, it's just inspiring individuals who, you know, overcome hurdles, real big obstacles. And I'm finding, to get personal straight away, I'm finding recently that like a subconscious link between a lot of these people is loss, and, you know, like the idea of grief and overcoming losing a loved one, which when I originally started was not a thing that I was even considering at all. But now I'm finding that common link. And like, it's not something that I've experienced myself, but it's something I've always been very fascinated in. And I think there's definitely a link there where I'm drawn to these people who have serious like major hurdles to overcome and become more successful as a result. And it does something to these people when they have a real low point that allows you to climb so much higher. And I think that's the exact sort of person that I want to put in this collection of celebrities that inspire me.
What are the lessons you've learned from these subjects, whether going deeper on that topic, it's how to grapple with loss or pain through art or something entirely different? Is there a common or consistent set of lessons or ideas that you've internalized over all of these videos?
I mean, I think the key one that is a commonality between everyone is you just can't give up. It goes without saying, and everyone knows it, but like you're not going to get through a dark patch or a dark period if you don't just completely believe in yourself and give up. And that's what everyone on the channel does. You know, I look at like Keanu Reeves, crazy, heartbreaking story, but just gets on with it and uses that pain for good. And so I think if you look through most of the videos, there's a very clear evidence of all those characters doing the same thing, of just knowing their worth and knowing that wallowing in pain is not the way forward, really.
What have you learned about dedication to craft in particular? I think there's a personal element to this idea of kind of hacking through the brush and continuing to forge your path regardless mm-hmm. of the obstacles. But I think that's maybe part and parcel of a larger thing, which is just like dedication to a craft, being obsessed with this thing. I think in particular, when I watched the Seinfeld and Nardwar videos, there was something about them that just, you saw this over a period of decades, just day to day. I think Seinfeld has this idea of like, that appeared on my podcast in another episode, of crossing out the calendar every day mm-hmm. when you do a joke, and it's just your job every day to produce jokes. So I'm curious what maybe more micro lessons you've taken away in terms of dedication to craft.
I don't know. I think there isn't much from the actual stories that we've covered, but I've learned a lot more from the process of starting this business and having it evolve from something much smaller before. And I think, you know, when people come to me and they say, what's like the one piece of advice, like I've got like one ready and secured forever, because it's like the biggest thing that was always to do with that drive and to do with that just continuous process is to just be doing something, one small thing every day, and doing something different every single day. But like, as part of the bigger picture, it's all these small things that I was developing different tools of skills and stuff. So then I could look back a year later and everything had been developed and improved. And I was, as a creative, as even just a person, I was more experienced in so many facets, which was so powerful for me. And it does lean into many of the subjects, I think, where they do so many different things and they try and dip their feet in and become talented, become masters sometimes at like so many different areas. And I've seen it with my own experience that's really, really useful and really powerful, rather than people tell you to just like focus on one thing, find your niche, you know, niche down, do this, become really good at this. And that is important. But I really kind of agree with the opposite, when it's just try as much as you can, build up everything you can. And it's not until you have tried it all, it's not until you've got some experience with everything, when you know exactly what you want to do and how you're going to use that to your best advantage.
You're still so young. I think you're 23. And so this idea of having explored enough to know what it is exactly you want to be doing, like there's still infinite depth within the domain of film. You still have a lot to explore. How do you balance understanding that you have carved out your own niche, how do you balance continuing to kind of exploit that and develop mastery in it versus broadening your scope and saying, well, there are other things I could be doing?
Well, I think, firstly, I'm not wedded to YouTube. I love it here, and it is, like I said, the perfect playground for me right now. And I do have every intention of mastering as much as I can here on YouTube because it's the best place to try it. But I do see it as that. I do see it as the, like, the place that I'm going to really, you know, find my strengths. And when I feel like I'm most confident and I'm strong enough, that's, I think, going to be the opportunity to try find something new. Right now, I'm not going to do it anytime soon. But yeah, YouTube is the place where I'm going to improve myself. And one day, I don't know if it's in 3, 5, 10 years, there's a cool opportunity and an offer, something bigger, different scale, or totally different. I'm 100% keen on that. And I don't see YouTube as my end game. It changes every day. But no, YouTube is just going to be like this thing for me right now. And it's the perfect place to just improve myself.
I think the thing you're alluding to that you have your sights on is cinema, is rolling out. Why not today? Why do you have to wait on a call from somebody? And this is to play a bit of devil's advocate and kind of prod you, but you have your audience. You could go rent out a theater tomorrow. You could rent out multiple theaters. Why do you feel like you're not ready?
As a craftsman, really, I think being able to draw an audience, one, which I kind of disagree. I don't know if I could do that yet, but irrelevant to that, I know when I get to that stage and there's another revolution to my career, there is two sides to it because there's part of me that could just sit here forever and say, oh, I'm not ready. I've got to find the next thing. But I also, I think there is a certain degree of like, I'll know when I'm ready and I'll know when I've made something where I truly believe if we put this on the big screen, then I'll be confident and proud of it. But even my most proud productions that I've made on YouTube, if you blew them up, you know, and put them on a big screen in front of 300 people, you'd scrutinize it in a whole new way. And it's a different art form, really. And yeah, when I'm ready, I'm ready.
What are those skills that you feel like you have to close the gap on to get to that next stage, to make that next leap? And I guess conversely, what are the things where you're feeling incredibly confident about? Like you are, you're never, of course, a master in anything, but you're at a certain point, you are moving in smaller and smaller chunks towards mastery. Like you feel like you're 99.9% there. So what are those things that like you have to get incredibly better at versus you feel really sound about?
Well, I mean, one, I've never tried anything longer than half an hour. So I don't know if that's a whole new ball game of working out how to tell a story of that length. It's, you know, it probably wouldn't be that different, but you know, that's just a whole new place I've never explored. I think every time we start a new project, I have to get over a couple weeks of remembering that we know how to do it, remembering how to get back on the horse. And I don't know if that's something that you'll ever truly get over, but starting a new project is a big hurdle for me every single time. And I don't know if that's something that just comes with becoming more of a seasoned creative. But you know, for me, it's definitely a big thing. And so I want to, like, you know, in cinemas and big productions, you've got to be truly confident in what you're making from the get-go, I think, especially when it comes to pitching. And right now we do a lot of taking it quite a long way and seeing how things evolve and developing big picture stuff still quite down the end of the pipeline. And that's a risk. That's definitely a risk we take every time. So that's something that could be improved upon. And I think that will be something that will happen when, one, there's a bigger team to sort of outsource these big early pre-production discussions with. We need more hands and eyes on that. So like, in terms of what I'm confident on, though, I really like that we can do something totally different every single time. We've got a certain format and a formula for telling these stories that I can rely on. But the part I enjoy the most about the process really is one of those early talks of working out how to do it differently and how to tell this story that's been told a million times with existing content. How can we do it in a way that no one's ever thought of and likely no one ever will again? And that's so fun. It's just the best part for me when there's infinite possibilities, unlimited potential. And, you know, like when we came up with Jim Carrey Doesn't Exist and the marketing for that were just really simple posters or just with him not in it. Like, that's so fun to me. And, you know,
very well executed.
Well, thank you. I was happy with that because it's such a simple concept that we could visualize just perfectly. And it doesn't always happen that way. We're struggling more this time around, and there's other times we've not done it that well. Finding those concepts and then finding a way to package it up, sell it, and have people kind of intrigued in it from the beginning. Definitely the most fun part for me, because like I said, there's just so much that could happen at that point. And then stage by stage, you're whittling down and finding what the video actually is. And sometimes it's a little bit different and then you have to kind of readjust things. Again, goes into the risk of doing things kind of late, but I'm having a blast.
As you look back on your career, you've been doing this for several years now. There's been, maybe it's only visible in hindsight that there's kind of these clear step function changes in the types of content or the quality of content. But I think about like you doing gaming videos, and then you were kind of doing educational videos around editing. You started to dabble in these like cultural documentaries. And then I think maybe around the Nardwar video is where there's like this next step function change.
Yeah.
As you look back, what do you associate? What were like the insights or the realizations that led to those changes in the types of content you were creating? If you remember, I know in part it might be a bit of a post-rationalization.
Well, it's funny that you bring up the gaming. Not many people know about that. That's a whole different era version of me, because that's just 13, 14-year-old Danny. And that's just, I mean, I started doing that because before that was like just short horror films with my friends, real life videos that we were shooting in the garden. And that was my real introduction into filmmaking. But then as I got more into that and started posting those to YouTube, fell in love with YouTube, got really hooked on that, and got hooked in on the gaming aspect to YouTube. And so I wanted to join in on the fun, replicate that, bought an HD PVR, started recording Call of Duty, made videos like that. Then realized that that wasn't cool as a 14-year-old in school. And some people laughed at you. The girls didn't like you, or like, you know, would laugh at it too, and quit doing that. Then realized that, oh, I kind of miss it, but I didn't miss the gaming. I missed the editing and the making of the videos. So went to uni, did that, did film, then started making short little TikToks about film. Then that blew up very quickly. Realized that I had an inclination to educate, as well as a good way of, I don't know, kind of an effective way of putting abstract concepts into informational videos and telling education succinctly. And that was a thing that I loved doing for a long time, and shining a light a little bit on film and education and doing things a little bit differently. Eventually got bored of that as well. And there was a part of me that thought, okay, I'm doing all this teaching about storytelling and filmmaking and editing. I'm not really doing much with it myself. It's just all things that I'm giving out to the world. And YouTube was birthed from that, from wanting to try and find a way to, you know, keep it to myself a little bit, you know, then show people the finished product. So that was started, lots of video essays I was doing, just still kind of doing the educational thing, but again, packaging it in a you know, a video essay format where I could still squeeze in bits of storytelling in there. Those old ones like the Sidemen video essay and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, they still feel very like I'm writing an essay rather than telling a story. And like you said, I think it was with Nardwuar, I set out to do the same thing. It was still very a video essay in my mind when scripting it, but somewhere during that production, I must have realized that this is more of a biography of a person's life, and I shouldn't really be laying down a clear point of what this man represents, and more so I want to try and just let him tell us. And it's a whole different perspective there, where you're kind of shifting the eyes and the voice. And yeah, Nardwuar started telling that story to me himself in the edit. And I was like, okay, this is a whole different thing. I think this is what the difference between a video essay and a documentary is. And yeah, didn't look back from that, because now that's my favorite style of storytelling and editing, where I'm just, you know, in Nardwuar, there was all that voiceover still that I was telling the viewer. Over time, that's reduced and reduced until, you know, Jim Carrey and my next one, it has no voiceover at all. Because I just want to try and let these subjects speak as much as they can and find ways of us telling the story as the creator and the filmmakers in different ways, ways that I don't feel are a bit of a cop-out like voiceover. That was a long-winded answer. I apologize.
No, I want more of those. More depth is better. I did really appreciate the... I think you're a great narrator, but the absence of narration in the latest video was another kind of turning point or defining moment in terms of your evolution. I also really appreciate the distinction between video essay and storytelling. One is maybe more linear and comes out with an opinion. Maybe that's what I inferred from what you were saying. But why is it... Why do you feel it's important to not have an opinion about the character? And I guess implicitly, you through the clips you choose to use, you are still stitching together some opinion about the subject, right? So how do you try to be opinionless with your selection of clips?
Well, look, yeah, as a filmmaker, it's impossible to be subjective. There's no such thing as a fly on the wall documentary. No matter what you do, no matter where you put a camera, no matter what shot you use, how long a shot lasts, you're making a statement with it. So should never be an urge to shy away from that or neglect it. Just know you are going to have a stance. Know you are going to bring yourself into any video and edit you put out. That's inevitable. Still though, like I said, we came with Jim Carrey with a concept and a way, something we wanted to say, and a side to Jim's life that we knew was most interesting to us and most resonated with us, and wanted to cover that for the audience. But just explicitly saying as a narrator, for example, oh, the interesting thing about Jim Carrey is he thinks he doesn't exist. Here's why, blah, 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 blah. There's so many other things we could do with the edit, with montage and, you know, back and forth editing and really getting kind of trippy and surreal with it, using music in an unconventional way, that we could express that and cover it in a way that was much, you know, much more impactful, in my opinion, had more power to it while actually saying less as a filmmaker. And so, you know, like we had the idea originally for that quite early on, was like, could we turn it into a bit of like a sci-fi horror movie where it's a little bit creepy and existentialist and has links to sort of old school sci-fi and weird, you know, I can't remember the filmmakers, but we had a whole long list of references of just like really trippy stuff from like the 60s and 70s. And we're using all those references to use it as a stylistic thing, because I think we as an audience, you pick up on those little subtle cues of things that remind you of other things that you might have seen years ago or whatever. And that can say a lot more than just being told something. It's when you come up with that idea yourself as a viewer, you start to realize, oh, I think I know where this is going. I can see something here. That's more important. And so we're always trying to have those conversations of how do we make the audience feel like they understand where this is going? And that opens the door for us to pull the rug as well later on when, you know, we're not telling you something and then later on saying, oh, by the way, that was a lie. You know, literally, we're just giving you the suggestion of what might be happening. And then changing that in the second half or whatever, and it being powerful and impactful that way. So it's really fun.
You mentioned this notion of educating yourself. There were elements from directors in the 60s that you intentionally thought about being inspired by in the creation of this video. How do you go about balancing that? This kind of harkens back to the explore exploit dynamic that I mentioned earlier, but how do you balance sticking with your existing or kind of natural or comfortable ways of creating videos versus going out and exploring new methods and pulling those in? And I guess the underlying question here is the development of taste. So taking what you've been experienced with or exposed to, and then balancing that with attempts at new methods.
Yeah. It's interesting because I can look back at the channel and see the biggest swings we've taken. And more often than not, it's a defining point in when something changed in the trajectory of the channel. And Adam Sandler was the first one without any face cam. That one goes without saying because it was a huge turning point for the channel. Jim Carrey was the first one without voiceover. And, you know, again, that was a big one. And so I think for me, in my corner of this production team and how I see it is, how can we keep taking things out of the toolbox that when we first started felt like we needed to have all of just to fit the criteria of what a YouTube video should be at its largest scale? It's like, how can we take these things away and fill that gap with an idea, with something, you know, a concept you can't really verbalize, or it isn't a tool or a thing. It's just like it's a fresh way of seeing it. It's a different perspective on the idea and the story. That's really confusing and complicated to try and explain. But, you know, like when you take out something physical, you have to put something in kind of figurative and metaphorical to fill that gap. And it more than fills the gap. It expands the whole thing into much something that it couldn't be before it. And that's just in my experience. I can't say that that's a unanimous experience for every creator, but it happens to me. And so I don't know what the next thing we will take away will be, but it has to be something that will just come naturally. And then, you know, down the line, voiceover will come back. But I think when it does come back, there has to be a real reason for it. And then, you know, for example, just spitballing, like if I were to come back and be a narrator in a video, then what does that mean? What am I saying to the audience there, that there is a narrator for this video? Because I want it to be such big thinking that's like, am I a storytelling device that's not just like an omniscient external YouTube commentator? Am I interweaved into the story somehow? Am I a radio journalist? You know, am I a detective, a producer who's trying to tell this story as part of a character in this wider universe? And so when you take things away, when you go to like put that piece of the puzzle back in, sometimes it's going to look different to you, and that you have to start seeing it slightly differently. And I like that that's happened to us because it's just expanded my whole thought process on the whole, you know, pipeline. I've drifted away from your question, I think, but
no, that's
but
totally
yeah,
fine.
Do you
feel like there's been early in your career, there was this orientation towards complexity, maybe to fill like a skill gap, and you've moved towards more simplicity and intentional use of different elements. And then to your point, you can come back later and decide, oh, I want to reintroduce this in a more functional or intentional way. Is that like a good characterization of kind of the
trajectory? I think that's the way I see it for sure. And it reminds me of, when like an app or like a software developer will have a feature for a long, long time and then it gets taken away. Apple does this, you know. And then years later, it gets reintroduced as this shiny new thing. And everyone's like, we already had this. It's making me see that in a different way now, where chances are, I think they're taking away something because it's too cluttered or it's distracting to the overall user experience. And when it comes back, it's because there's room for it. There's a space for it. It's needed in this new version of this app. And I think we can see being a creative, being a video maker as the same thing. It's like when you start early on, there's a real urge sometimes to just try and replicate what you see. And there's all these different things you're consuming. And so you're like, I want a bit of that, a bit of that, a bit of that. And it ends up get you kind of engorge your process and it gets overwhelming. And as a user and as a consumer, that can be distracting and hard to process. And so I think part of maturing as a creator is realizing what actually speaks to you and what's actually needed for you and stripping those bits away, getting a bit skinnier. And then from that kind of finding the opposite end of the spectrum where things can start coming in again, but on a more focused way.
How opinionated are you at the outset about the end product? Do you set any kind of constraints on it? Like it's going to be 20 or 30 minutes. I want it to go in this direction. Or do you start entirely with research, go very deep, educate yourself on the subject. And then to your point, it's kind of, okay, how do we piece this back together? How do we strip this back? Because I'm sure you have tens of hours of research that you're working with that you then create a 20 or 30 minute clip out of.
Yeah, it's a lot of work that goes in from the beginning. And yeah, I never have preconceived expectations of what it should be from the beginning. And I think that's bad, especially when you're telling someone else's story. I think it's really important to me that we tell that story in a way that they would themselves. And so you have to hear them out first before coming with any ideas how you feel like it should be. You wouldn't sit down with one of these subjects in real life on your first meeting and say, hey, here's how it should go, bish, bash, bosh. You'd let them talk for an hour and just see how they would say it. Mm-hmm. And that's important. So we can't have that one-on-one conversation. So you have to put the hours in then to learn as much as you can about these people. And then from that, it informs you in those small things, but still like duration and time. That's a kind of irrelevant to me. It's however long it takes to tell a story is however long it takes to tell a story. And I don't want to like ever pigeonhole ourselves into a different way of doing it. It's just however it evolves is how it evolves. And that's always like my ethos is just let it breathe.
That's beautiful. Yeah. It's emergent and you're trying to channel the art through you. You aren't trying to have like a stranglehold on the art. To that end, how do you know when a video is ready? Is it, I imagine some amount of it is a checklist, right? We've got to make sure the audio's at these levels, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But is there overall in like a macro sense, like, is it just a gut feeling?
Yeah, I think it's a gut feeling. We do, in every project, look for like a North Star. And for me, the best example of that North Star is in the Drew Barrymore video with the rain, when she's, you know, previously in her life when she was still struggling, just said, one day I hope I'll be able to go out and enjoy the rain. And it's confusing then on its own as a standalone clip. Years later, when we find a clip of her as an adult enjoying dancing in the rain, and you put those two things together, it all falls into place. And that was the North Star then. We find it really early on. Mm. And we knew that, like, once we had achieved that, the video was done. Nothing more had to be said. You just had to find all the stepping stones between those two points that link them in a powerful way. And sometimes it's as simple as that. Like, okay, we know the ending, we know the beginning. Just got to find the middle. It's not always going to be that straightforward. And you have to kind of, in the past, we've had to work out where the story should end, because it's still going, everyone's still unfolding. But it does take a little bit of chipping away sometimes to work out, okay, what is specifically this story we want to say in this person's wider story? And that takes more discussion and thinking about what fascinates and interests us the most. But it is a gut feeling. It's just when you feel like enough has been said and there's a real emotional arc in there, maybe you've cried. You know, that's always the goal for me, is like, can I make anyone I watch this early on get emotional? Then something's happened, and that's really powerful. If there's none of that throughout, there's definitely still work to be done, because that's always the priority for me, is like, we have to leave people with something. And that only comes by testing it with other people and just feeling it within you yourself.
Is there a common emotion you're trying to elicit through all of these videos? Or again, it goes back to letting the subject speak, tell their story, and there's inevitably some kind of emotion that will be generated as a result of that?
Well, it's both. I think, yeah, it's everyone's story is slightly different, but there are so many common links between these stories, and we pick them for one reason, really, because they inspire us. So right. I want to transfer that. Can we inspire people to overcome whatever they are going on in their life and reach their best versions of themselves? Still along the way, like, as a selfish filmmaker, when you want to, we never want to prey on negativity or make people feel bad for the sake of it. But if you can, as a filmmaker, make someone sad, that's really, you should be proud of your ability to do that. But if you can take that, then turn it on its head and use that as inspiration and something that's powerful, then that's even more inspiring. And so that's what we're trying to do. It's like, never just sad, never just happy. But if there's a way that we can bridge those emotions and end on a high, then that's the emotion I want people to feel. Yeah.
How do you balance? I think this is probably increasingly a problem or a consideration as you grow and get more traction. How do you balance creating for yourself, which is probably exclusively what you were doing at the beginning, to now you're at this point where you have a sizable audience that you have to pay attention to. And it's also a business. There's kind of a monetary, whether it's at the forefront or it's a byproduct of the work, there's monetary considerations.
Yeah.
So what is like the negotiation like and trade-offs between these three different perspectives? How do you navigate that?
Wow. Yeah, this is a whole conversation. It's actually not a conversation or something I thought about until Drew Barrymore, because, you know, up until Adam Sandler, I was just making exactly what I wanted to make and was still finding success and traction. And those two things aligned. The Venn diagram was a circle. And I was like, wow, okay, I found my perfect niche straight away. I didn't have to try and filter anyone out. It just happened. And I can be telling these stories that that really resonate with me. And clearly hundreds of thousands, millions of people also want to see it. then I did it again with one more with Drew Barrymore. I was like, okay, this is a story that I really feel like is amazing and people should hear about. And it also resonates with me. And it's like on a personal individual level, it speaks to my heart. Directly rolls out after Adam Sandler, which was this super hit. And it was a wake up moment where I was like, oh, okay, these things aren't always going to align. And it's going to find a new subset of people every single time. And it's not like your YouTube subscriber count is this room of every single one of them who are focused and eager and waiting for the big video to load. That's not how it works.
It's a great metaphor.
And with Drew, it was, we had to really like sit and think, okay, what are we making these videos for? How much does this shake us? Because it did a bit, but I think that was only because it was in such direct contrast with the video before it. And it stung a little bit, but I don't know. In hindsight, I have no guilt, or I mean, no regrets in making that, absolutely, because it's still one of my favorites. But I don't know. I think, yeah, for me, I don't ever want to sacrifice the our craft or the art that we want to make in favor of more people will see this, or we might make a bit more money doing this, or even just doing it that way. So I think always a priority is like, this is my library. This is my channel. I want this to really speak to my art and who I am as a person. And it will evolve eventually until I can take a step away from it a bit. But for now, like, this is me. I want this to be the poster for my, you know, perspective on the life and world and art. And so I don't want to do that too much, but we have been talking about it more recently with, okay, how can we find the next 10 videos? Who are the next 10 names? And there'd be a good middle ground where we think, okay, this person would be a safe bet, but maybe only in this time of the year when something like this is coming out. And so there's much more of a, I don't know, I'm just more aware of it now, definitely more of a conversation happening, but still the priority is just like, what do we want to make ourselves?
On the note of trade-offs, I think one of the things that's obvious for all of the subjects that you've covered, in order for you to get to that level of success, greatness, acclaim, you have to inevitably trade off in other areas of your life. If you're going to commit 99% of your effort to a craft, something has to fall by the wayside, and in some cases, lots of things. How do you think about, maybe in your own life, as you pursue this goal, what you're having to trade off in order to execute on that vision? And what kind of maybe concerns do you have about that?
I don't know, maybe I feel like maybe I'm lucky that the way I live my life normally seems to be the way that I can create normally, and I don't feel like I sacrifice much. I was definitely sacrificing more in that period, like I said, when I was trying more and really getting my feet wet in doing as much as I can. And I see that as more of a grind era. Now I'm more comfortable and satisfied in the type of creator that I am. And there's more confidence in taking some time off, for example, or relaxing and not having to work 12 hours a day and having more of a life, you know, because I think when you're up and coming, like I still am, but like when you're really starting out new, then you don't really trust who you are as a creative yet. And so you feel like you have to prove yourself to yourself and everyone around you every day. And that's good because that's what drives you forward. But I don't feel that anymore. I don't want to like get complacent ever, but there's definitely a middle ground, a safe spot I found where I'm like, okay, it's still going to get done. And I trust myself that things are going to get done in a way that I'm proud of, but I also can take the evening off, you know? And, so no major sacrifices, at least yet in my career, but I'm aware of the things that will happen. Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah, I imagine it comes in waves, or it's cyclical, especially as you take that next leap. But that's good to hear that you don't feel like you're in that position of kind of overexertion in one area of your life at the expense of something else. You had this tweet recently that really resonated with me, because when you think about your craft, it's I mean, this probably is the case for lots of crafts, but I think it's especially apparent within film. It's this collection of a lot of like soft and hard skills. There's like you need to be good at software having to do with editing, but you also need to be good at storytelling. And your tweet was that creativity isn't a skill you can ever master. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. Well, I stand by it, because it's like saying mastering being a person. You know, it's like it's something. It's a statue that will never be finished. Even on your deathbed, you can still learn something new, and you're never going to become a master at creativity. It's just not something that can be done. You can get more confident at it every day, but no, it's detrimental, I think, to feel like it's something you can conquer, because it's not. It's just something that's within your heart, and our personal experiences and our real life is always going to influence the way that you see creativity. Is forever changing, and that's the beauty of it, is that we're going to evolve through so many different phases of our life and different versions of you, and that will see the perspective of art in a completely different way. And I will look back on the stuff I'm making now in 10 years probably and laugh at it or cringe at it or say, oh, that's exactly how I felt at that time, and be proud of it. And like that could, who knows? It's up in the air. But I think there's real like bravery and honor in embracing the fact that you're going to change loads in your life, and understanding that the way that you're going to use your creativity is going to change a lot too. And being 25, being 30, being 50, being 70, and saying, okay, I've sussed it, I figured it out, is wrong, in my opinion. Even Martin Scorsese said recently, it's like, you know, he feels like he has so much more to say, and just now he feels like he's only maturing as a filmmaker, which I like. That's fascinating. And it's anyone who's ever tried to create anything in your life, like, it should resonate with you, because that's just the beauty of it.
Is this focus on growth and process something that always came naturally to you, or were you initially more kind of goal-oriented, I can achieve this thing, I can be done with it, and you had to teach yourself this just through the process of creating tons of work?
Maybe this is something that, like you asked earlier, something that I might have picked up on from the subject unconsciously. I was never like a huge goal-oriented guy. I mean, I'm not even a to-do list guy. I just kind of take the minute by the minute. But I've always had bucket list things. And, you know, I don't know, just being a kid, had a very strong thing on the bucket list, which was be in the cinema and see my name on the credits list with my mom sitting next to me. And that's like the only thing that's ever been on the bucket list. And I think just having like a real, I don't know, that was something that I could achieve. It was actionable, but it's not like, I don't know, determined by hitting a metric or, you know, achieving something kind of vapid. It was just one thing that meant something to me and my family, which is the type of goal that I think is worth seeking and yearning for. But no, I couldn't really care about how many subscribers I or someone has or how much money I have. It's just, you know, the type of person that I am at the moment that's always trying to use that to my advantage and seeing, just, you know, being open-minded for where things go in the future.
I think that's a necessary perspective to be successful in the long haul. I think a lot of creators might, if they're being honest, say that validation or absence of validation is a big fear of theirs. And if you're focused on the process, that can hopefully alleviate some of that pressure.
Yeah.
To build on this, if validation isn't kind of your biggest fear as a creator, what is it? And how do you keep that at bay or at arm's length?
Well, it's something that's way scarier in my opinion. And that is something that I actually faced a little bit of, a sprinkle of it this month in October, because I took some time off. I took a couple of weeks off and visited America and stuff and had a bunch of fun. And I went away with the, I don't know, the confidence that like I'd be building up this pool of creativity and ideas in my head and my body while I was away. And I could just, and I would have been itching to get back in this seat and try something new and get back at it. And it didn't happen. It took at least a couple weeks of really like just pushing the wheel around every single day. And there was a part where I was like, oh my God, I think I've lost it. I think I've lost it. Whatever I had a spark or something that I didn't, was never aware of, but it's not there anymore. And I could feel that absence. Mm. And there was a bit of a worry just for a bit. I spent most of last week trying to cut the intro for the next video, which is something I normally do in a couple of days, maybe with a script and stuff. I can bash it out pretty quickly. And I'm confident in my ability to do that. It wasn't happening. Something was broken. And even though I had everything I needed, we had a script that was in my mind, like perfectly to what I wanted to say. It was all ready to go. I just couldn't transfer it. I couldn't find it. Things weren't working. And I was like, wow, I've never lost it before. And there was just a brief period of time where I thought, okay, how am I going to find this back? Can it come back? And naturally, you've got to just find the rhythm again. I was just get back in the flow, because taking time off was something I'd never done before. But it was scary. Yeah. And I think that is something that in the future, I'm going to be aware of when taking breaks is, yes, you are going to lose that a little bit. Whatever you had before, it's just going to take some time to come back again and not get anxiety and fear that you've lost it, you know, and feel like you're not going to be able to create anymore, because it was worrying for a second.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying. But I imagine it's more a function of muscle memory and just needing to get back in the gym,
yeah,
per se,
essentially,
than actually losing it. In closing, I always ask guests the same final question, which is, to flip it around on you, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
Let's stick on a similar theme. So I guess, well, if you were to take almost everything out of your existing toolbox as an individual and as someone who puts things out into the world, and you had to focus on one thing. So as a podcaster, you know, you could have video, audio, all these multitude of platforms, all these different ways of putting out into the world. You know, you could do this on stage. This could be written and done on like a New York Times post, you know, just the idea, the concept of interviewing. If you could take everything away and just have one way of doing it, I think finding that is really important in knowing exactly who you are as a creator and then branching everything from that. So do you know what yours is?
I'd have to say research and preparation. It's funny you asked this question, because I was texting with one of my best friends the other day, who coincidentally was one of the people that recommended I interview you. Mm. And it's often imperceptible, I think, to the person what it is they are excellent at. It's often a thing that comes naturally to you, but other people look at and they can say,
yes,
oh, you're great at that. I don't have that. I appreciate that. But people don't often vocalize that either. So I asked him, I'm like, what's the thing you think I'm great at? And it's just a thing I've been thinking about. But the thing I've arrived at is, yeah, probably something around research as it pertains to my guests, like really trying to get into their psychology, the why behind what it is that they do. I try to ask a lot of like deep kind of prodding, seeking questions from a philosophical perspective. Hopefully not too much in this episode. No, but yeah, I think that's where I'm at. And yet I don't feel 100% confident. So still need to refine that sense of what it is I need to focus on or what my core skill set is. What would you say yours is?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, we're very similar because, yeah, I would say a similar thing where it's just the deep dive into people and then using that in a way of finding out how to tell that story in a unique way. So I on a similar note, love diving into people and seeing where it takes me and then, using that to my advantage. But that's such an interesting thought because we come like from a common ancestor, you know, like we're both from an evolution tree. We've got a different direction in different formats of telling stories and using art, but we come from a one link of interest, which is like, that's fascinating. Think about all the people in the world who like can branch off and do thousands of different things, but there's one similar North Star that we all are fascinated by. It's really
cool. That compulsion to tell stories.
Yeah.
Express. Excellent. Well, Danny, thank you so much for your time. This was a blast, both to, as I mentioned, research you and your work, but then also to have this conversation. So appreciate your time.
Yeah, likewise, man. This was very fun. Great questions.